No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esti Dinor. Our topic today is a new book, National Insecurity of American Militarism. The author who's with us today is Mel Goodman. He's an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University. He was division chief and senior analyst at the Office of Soviet Affairs for the CIA from 1976 to 1986. He was also a senior analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the State Department from 1974 to 1976 and an intelligence advisor to the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks in Vienna and Washington. He's co-author of The War of Edward Shevardnadze, The Phantom Defense, America's Pursuit of the Star Wars Illusion, Bush League Diplomacy, How the Neoconservatives Are Putting the World at Risk, that's from 2004, and Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. And hello, Mel, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Esti. Good to be with you.
So tell us first, how does a former CIA and State Department analyst become someone who writes against American militarism?
Well, that is not only a good question, but it's going to be the subject of my next book, To Dissent. I think there's something that people don't understand about the intelligence business, and I was in it for 42 years, with security clearances for 42 years, including the U.S. Army as a cryptographer. And one of the things that I think is essential to being an intelligence analyst and a good intelligence analyst is to be somewhat contrarian. You can't accept the conventional wisdom. You can't assume or make assumptions based on limited evidence. You have to be a bit of a contrarian. And I think I've always been that contrarian. And in the 1980s, when you had a CIA director, William Casey, and his deputy, Robert Gates, who became Secretary of Defense under George W. Bush and even Barack Obama, you had the terrible politicization of intelligence. And that was a turning point for me, and it's why I left the CIA in 1986 to go to the National War College to teach in the Department of International Relations. And the more I witnessed the misuse of intelligence, first with regard to the Soviet Union in the 1980s, the failure to anticipate the 9/11 attacks, which were, I think, legitimate mistakes. They weren't politicization. But particularly the run-up to the war against Iraq, which was an immoral war and an illegal war, and based on phony intelligence, contrived intelligence, some intelligence made out of whole cloth, I thought it was essential that people understand what the intelligence business is all about. What are its strengths, what are its weaknesses, and particularly to point out failures because the oversight process, particularly on the Hill in the Senate, has been a complete failure. You know, the Congress is dysfunctional. I think that's something we can all agree on. And the Senate Intelligence Committee is particularly dysfunctional, and we saw that yesterday in the so-called confirmation hearings for John Brennan. So I think it was important for someone to be willing to explain from the inside of the system what intelligence is supposed to do, what it's for, and how it can be misused. So the first book was The Failure of Intelligence, Decline and Fall of the CIA. That was the first part in the scheme. The second part was to deal with the militarization of national security policy, the militarization of our foreign policy, the militarization of the intelligence community, which is what this second book is all about. National Insecurity, the Cost of American Militarism. And then the third book, because it's now become a triad, will be The Path to Dissent, to explain, as you asked so aptly, you know, why would someone in this position become a contrarian? And that's what I hope to explain in that book. But the contrarian roots were always there. I think what's, if anything's different now, it's the need to explain why change is essential on the part of the United States, that this misuse of force, misuse of funding, misuse of covert action is costing us dearly. And it came up to a certain extent yesterday in the hearings with the discussion of the drone activity. But it is, there are so many aspects to this that need to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. So before we get to talking about your book, I just want to continue inquiring about the same issue here for just a little bit longer. You say that things have changed in the 80s. I wonder, do you feel that before that intelligence was not manipulated for political reasons, or were you just naive before that, or what do you think? I mean, is it a personal thing, or was there really a change in the 80s, and if so, how and why?
That's another good question to deal with. I think there has always been the risk of politicization of intelligence and the misuse of intelligence, and whenever this country has gone to war, Mexican War in the 1840s, the Spanish-American War in the 1890s, certainly Vietnam. I'm talking about wars of choice, in which the resolution, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, was based on misuse of intelligence. There's always been the problem of misusing intelligence to suit the interests of policymakers. What was different about the 1980s? Was that you had a very institutionalized process. You had a very ideological director, a real neocon before we called these people neocons. That was Bill Casey. And then you had a very ambitious young deputy director for intelligence, Bob Gates, who was prepared to do anything that Bill Casey required, requested, and in some cases demanded. So Casey was trying to drive his president, Ronald Reagan, to the right, and I think Bob Gates was trying to impress his director, his boss, with how capable he could be in helping move the entire intelligence process to the right. So I confess to maybe a certain amount of naivete about what intelligence was and what the CIA was all about, but I do think I'm correct in saying you had this terrible institutionalization in the 1980s that was different than anything we had seen before, and then you got the worst case of institutionalization when you had intelligence politicized to go to war against Iraq in 2003. So from the 80s till 2003, certainly you had the risk of the misuse of intelligence, and I would argue the problem has just... has not been corrected sufficiently. And if anything, you've weakened the process, you've weakened the oversight process, you've weakened the strategic process, you've weakened the capability of the CIA particularly to do serious intelligence research.
Mm-hmm. You don't seem to think from your book that the Obama administration has changed things or improved things. Has it? What is the relationship of the Obama administration to the intelligence apparatus, and what about the wars that are still going on, and the drones, and the covert operations? Is any of them necessary, in your opinion?
Well, there's a lot there. Let me start with the first part, dealing with Obama, and then you can pick up the pieces and see where you want to direct me after that. The important thing is to get my views on Obama on the table. I think Obama came into the White House extremely naive. You know, if you want to talk about naivete,
mm-hmm.
This is a man who had very little experience in terms of national security, very little experience in terms of foreign policy. He didn't know the foreign policy community. So if you look at his national security team the first time around, starting in 2009, this was an extremely weak national security team. Two people were selected for domestic reasons, which is the worst way to appoint your foreign policy team. And of course, that would be Hillary Clinton, who's was not successful as Secretary of State, again, despite the conventional wisdom. I would argue just the opposite. And keeping Bob Gates on at the Pentagon as Secretary of Defense was a huge disappointment to all of those, or many of the of us, who supported Barack Obama. And both appointments were designed to appease domestic opinion. Obama wanted the Clintons on his side, and he certainly wanted to convince the right and the very conservatives and neocons in this country that he could keep Bob Gates on as Secretary of Defense and that he wasn't going to rattle any chains at the Pentagon. Then he put in a retired Marine general, James Jones, as a national security advisor, which turned out to be a disaster, and he had to be replaced very quickly. And his CIA director was Leon Panetta, who was, I think, a very tired bureaucrat at this point, soon captured by the operational mentality of the CIA. So the first term for Obama was one in which he really caved into the military and followed the military lead. Now, in the book, I do argue at the end, because when I completed the book, we were still in the first term, but I am convinced that Obama, or at least I'm hopeful, let's put it that way, that Obama has learned from his first term experience, that he knows he gave in to the Pentagon far too often. With the one exception of John Brennan, I think his appointments in national security have been better. The selection of John Kerry is far superior to the appointment of Hillary Clinton. John Kerry has prepared all of his adult life for this particular job. And the selection of Chuck Hagel, I think, is an extremely good appointment, despite the rough treatment he got in front of the Senate Armed Forces Committee a couple of weeks ago, which I thought was outrageous and mainly a personal attack. Chuck Hagel is someone who knows that the use of the military should always be the last resort, and I think he would be a good secretary and a good steward for defense at a time when we are going to have to cut the defense budget over the next 10 years. That's just a fact. How much we cut is open for debate, but there will be at least $500 billion worth of cuts over the next 10 years, and you want a responsible person in that position to oversee those cuts. The CIA director is another matter. The selection of John Brennan, which I opposed in 2009 because that's Obama wanted to make him the CIA director in the first term, but there was some pushback from critics such as myself who knew Brennan's role with regard to extraordinary renditions and a lot of the law-breaking activities of the CIA. But apparently Obama thinks that Brennan has been laundered now with 4 years in the White House and now wants to make him the CIA director. That's unfortunate, because it gets to an area that you raised in your questions about the drone activity. Essentially, John Brennan, as the Deputy National Security Advisor for Counterterrorism, is the father of the drone program as we practice it. I have a lot of problems with the drone program in how it's been manipulated, but the fact is that with this drone program, and Brennan, as I say, is the architect, we now have, in most circles in the United States, an acceptance of assassination as a very routine part of U.S. foreign policy. So you have a press spokesman, Jay Carney, speaking for the president, calling the targeted killings and essentially assassinations of the CIA as legal, ethical, and wise. You now find it's lawful to even kill Americans without due process. In other words, ignoring the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, as long as informed high-level officials see evidence of an imminent attack. Well, what is an informed high-level official? And an informed high-level official where? At the CIA? At the White House? The Pentagon, some other institution.
And how do you define an imminent attack?
An imminent attack? attack, you know, that kind of intelligence, I know from my 42 years of experience in the intelligence business, is very hard to acquire. And remember, when we went to war in 2003, illegally, in my estimation, that entire decision was based on flawed intelligence. And if you read the memoirs, as I have, of George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, all of the bad actors from the decision to go to war, they will all blame it on the intelligence community. Well, that's nonsense. The White House demanded certain kinds of intelligence, and you had a CIA director who said it was a slam dunk, Mr. President, to provide it for you. So that process led to very flawed intelligence, led to war, led to over 4,000 Americans killed in Iraq, and who knows how many civilians, particularly innocent civilians in Iraq, because Donald Rumsfeld didn't even want to count these people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really time to blow a whistle, call time out here, and to take a very hard look at American foreign policy in a very large sense, and look at very specific aspects of it, such as the use of the drones to conduct this policy of assassination, which means you have a CIA officer sitting in a trailer somewhere in New Mexico pressing a button that unleashes a Hellfire missile that could destroy any target. In one case, it was a car that happened to be carrying a 16-year-old boy who was an American citizen, who was killed along with several others. This CIA officer presses this button, and then he goes home and maybe plays ball with his children in his backyard and has dinner with his family. I don't think war should be that easy. I don't think war should be that commonplace. I don't think we should be conducting military activities in countries and areas where we are not even at war. You know, where are these drones being used? Pakistan, we're not at war with Pakistan. Yemen, Somalia, we're not at war with those places. We kept secret, when I say we, the press, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, bowed to the urgings of the CIA and didn't write about a secret base for drones in Saudi Arabia. Now the United States is trying to get a secret base in Niger, which would widen the arc of drone activity. Are we going to conduct these assassinations now in Libya, in Mali, in Nigeria? There is just so much we don't know, and we're operating under this terrible oxymoron of secret laws.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what in the world are secret laws? You also have an attorney general who acknowledged the importance of due process, but this is a quote from a speech he made about a year ago. Eric Holder said, due process doesn't mean a judicial process. Well, if it doesn't involve a judicial process, what in the world is due process?
I guess that's secret, too.
Where are the checks and balances in the system?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mel, we have a number of callers for you, even though I didn't give the numbers yet. The numbers are 256.
Well, you have very clairvoyant callers.
They are 256-2001, 1-866-899-WORT. Please don't call if you have called in the past 7 days. I just want to say before we go to our first caller that we have a film festival here every year, Mel, and I think it was 2 years ago that I saw this amazing movie, indie movie. I don't know that anyone has heard about it except people who saw it in situations like that, in which drones had become one of the regular things that the corporations use. And so there's this situation there where Mexicans work in Mexico, but they work in the United States because they build things through being attached to machines. And so they work them for 18-hour days, and they do this work from, they don't even have to cross the border to be paid $5 a day or whatever. And on the other hand, there's the corporations that have the drones. And so whenever things happen, in this case in Mexico, you know, throughout the world, in this case, the guy who's working in one of these virtual maquiladoras, comes from a village where a corporation wants the water. And the villagers are objecting to that and protesting it. And so there goes the drone. And his family gets killed.
The National Insecurity, the Cost of American Militarism, I get into the drone activity. And one thing your audience ought to think about is the precedent that we're now establishing for using drones in international situations, flying across borders and targeting individuals based on very limited evidence. There are now 48 countries, according to my research, that either have or are working on a drone capability. Israel has them. They've used them in the Gaza. Hezbollah, based in Lebanon, has received technology from Iran. They've overflown Israel. Russia has them. China. Japan's working on this. Do we want an international environment where countries are taking it on their own without any real checks or balances or open discussion, taking warfare to a much different, undeclared level? This is an extremely dangerous precedent.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, they're being used more and more by police forces throughout this country.
Domestically, there are people who claim there's a need for them.
Yes,
in the domestic arena.
Yeah. Well, let's get to the phones. My guest is Mel Goodman. He's an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA and State Department analyst, the writer most recently of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. I've got two questions I hope I can ask.
Sure.
And the first one, going into this war, what happened to Valerie Flame and Joe Wilson? Was there any blowback within the agency over what amounted to pure treason,
mm-hmm.
who I feel on the part of Karl Rove? And the other question I had was, I listened to BBC reporting at the very onset of Shock and Awe, and I thought you made a Freudian slip today when you said, it sounded like you said Sony instead of phony. And one of the things that the BBC reported at the initial onset was that one of the first people on the ground in Iraq were Sony Corporation, and they're writing intellectual property law involving the new country there.
Mm-hmm.
I'll wait for my answers. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mel.
Well, I didn't say Sony. I said phony, so let's...
It was a Freudian slip on the colors.
Wilson matter is interesting. I know both of them. There was a serious violation of domestic law, the same violation that led a CIA operations officer to be sent to jail for 30 months.
Mm-hmm.
This decision just came down from the courts a few weeks ago. John Kiriakou will be serving 30 months in jail for giving up the name of someone undercover to a journalist, even though the journalist never reported that name. What Dick Cheney, the vice president, did, along with Scooter Libby, and I believe Karl Rove was involved in this, but Karl Rove tried to fess up with the FBI investigators, so they dropped the investigation of Rove. But clearly, Dick Cheney was behind this decision to give Valerie Plame's name to a group of journalists. Valerie Plame was undercover. Her husband, Ted Wilson, was a former ambassador at the State Department, well known to the foreign policy community. He had gone out to Niger and to prove, and he did so successfully, that Niger didn't have enriched uranium and they weren't providing enriched uranium to Iraq, which, of course, was the big lie in Bush's State of the Union speech in January 2003. It was Wilson's work that angered Cheney and led him to compromise Valerie Plame's identity. In 1983, after an American station chief, a CIA station chief in Athens, Greece, was assassinated, his name was Richard Welch, a law was passed making it a federal offense to give up the name of any operations officer undercover. Cheney wasn't declared an unindicted co-conspirator, which I think he should have been, but his chief aide, Scooter Libby, was, but his sentence was commuted by President George Bush. Mm-hmm. Cheney wanted the his aide to be pardoned. That Bush wouldn't do, but he did commute the sentence, and he never served any time in jail. So that's a good example of the double standard that exists in the government. If you serve the interests of the government, then you are not punished, such as Scooter Libby. But if you are contrary to the policy that a particular administration is trying to put into play, then you could be vulnerable. And that's what happened to Valerie Plame. Plame and Wilson are now living in New Mexico, and they've both written. Her book was turned into a movie, and they're doing well. But Scooter Libby, along with others, should have served some time for violating a very serious federal law. And your caller uses the word treason. He uses it, that word, pointedly, and I would agree with it. As far as the CIA, I think they were cowards. There should have been some protest activity at the CIA. There should have been more moral support for a colleague such as Valerie Plame. But basically, there was silence, and that was discouraging. That's always something I find very disturbing, to see how bureaucrats can be cowed just so easily.
Mm-hmm. What about this second question, Sony in Iraq?
I have no idea what he's talking about.
I think
I
basically
didn't use the word Sony, so I...
I know.
I have to ask the caller.
What he's asking, maybe in a bigger kind of picture, is the role... The fact that corporations were in Iraq right away, and the first guy...
Well, I don't know what that means. We didn't go to war for to support the interests of American capitalism.
No, you don't think so?
You know, we have gotten into situations on for that reason. You know, we went into Iran in 1953 and overthrew the democratically elected government of Iran because of the threat of nationalization of our oil interests and British oil interests. And there have been confrontations, certainly in Chile in the 1970s and in Central America. But the war with Iraq had nothing to do with American capitalism or American corporations, in my estimation. This was a war that served no interests other than the personal interests of George Bush, who wanted to establish himself as a war president and to prove successful in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Cheney's interest was in creating a more powerful president, and there's no better way to create a president with greater powers than to go to war. And Donald Rumsfeld was trying to establish that you can be successful with very limited use of military power. And of course, he was incredibly wrong. The war turned out to be unwinnable, even if we had put more troops into Iraq. But I wouldn't spend a lot of time worrying about the role of Sony and corporations. It's just not, I don't think it's germane to what we're talking about.
Uh-huh. You don't think the Iraq war was at least partially about oil?
No, I don't.
You don't?
I know that. Again, that's the conventional wisdom. But remember, you're talking to a contrarian. Don't expect me
okay.
to adopt all the conventional wisdom that people read about and hear about. That's I try to look beyond that. And the more I look, I just don't see it.
Uh-huh.
And clearly, if it was about oil, it was a huge failure, because all the oil companies that are going into Iraq, for the most part, are not American oil companies. You know, look very closely at who's in Iraq and who's exploiting the oil markets in Iraq, and the United States companies are a very small share of that. So if that was the reason, it was a huge failure, but I don't even believe it was the reason.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get to our next caller. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hello. We recall the disastrous events that led up to the war in Iraq, and I like to look to Hans Blix and his team, a very competent, adequately staffed team that went into Iraq, looked for weapons of mass destruction, found none after 6 weeks of intensive looking, in months, in fact, and 6 weeks later... the Bush administration was all over going to war. Condoleezza Rice was interviewed in national networks and came out repeatedly and said that everybody believed that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq when she was trying to justify the Bush invasion. In fact, the UN investigator assigned to that task, Blix, came out conclusively without and said there was no evidence of that. So it begs the question, what is the soul of the I'm eager to ask your guest, because I'm sure he reflects on this. What is the soul of the American people and their devotion to humanitarianism if this is the accepted, in fact, enthusiastically pursued foreign policy of the United States?
I just, before we ask Mel to answer, I'm trying to understand exactly your question. Are you being cynical, or are you actually trying to say that there are two? Oh, I guess he's gone. Okay. Mel, maybe...
I think I understand the question.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I don't think he's being cynical, so let me try to answer it.
Yes.
The first point about Hans Blix is extremely important, and again, I discuss it in my book, National Insecurity. Blix had an incredible line about U.S. decision-makers, and he was talking about Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and people like Condi Rice. All these people have lied in their memoirs, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And Blix said, and he was a career international public servant and an expert in these kinds of investigations of weapons of mass destruction, he said he has never seen another situation where there has been 100% certainty and 0% evidence. The American who was sent out, David Kay, came to the same conclusion, that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And there were many of us who knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. And some of us, and I was a member of this group, tried to call journalists. And we called journalists from the New York Times and had no luck because they had a reporter by the name of Judith Miller,
right,
who was part of the effort to get the country to go to war. We called people at the Washington Post and had no luck. The only success we had was two reporters from the Philadelphia Inquirer, Scripps Howard paper, who did pursue the information that we gave and determine, right, there were no weapons of mass destruction. So your caller, I think, raises a very important existential point about, I think he used the words, the soul of the American people.
Yes.
And I guess that's the right word. The important thing that he's dealing with, and I happen to agree with him, is who are we as a people that we not only accepted this war and accepted the lies, but then we turned around the following year and reelected the person who brought us this war. And it's the question is, who are we as a people? And I've always argued in these situations that countries get the governments they want and the countries they deserve. And in the case of George Bush's second term, this was clearly the government we wanted, and I guess it was the government we deserved. And the reason why I cut Obama a lot of slack is I think people have underestimated the terrible situation that he inherited in 2009. It was not only the two unwinnable wars and an economy that was falling apart, there was also a government that was falling apart. The damage that Bush and Cheney did to the institutions of government, to our civil society, to our regulatory agencies, all of this had to be rebuilt. And Obama has had a lot of progress, made a lot of progress, and had a lot of success in this regard. But obviously there's still problems that are there, and those of us in the liberal community, I think, are disappointed that Obama hasn't gone further. But he inherited a terrible situation.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get to our next caller. Please do not wait until 5 minutes to the hour before you call. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm just curious, like, who is in charge of making arrests for the wrongdoings of anyone that's in this country, regardless of their position, their elected position? Who, you know, what is it? The U.S. Marshals? I mean, who's the ultimate law enforcement for the United States of America?
Uh-huh. Okay. Interesting question. Do you know, Mel?
yes and no. I mean, there's no one who's in this capacity. The system that we should be able to use, however, that would achieve some of the same ends would be going through the judicial process, going through the courts, trying to determine the role of torture and abuse in American foreign policy, try to determine what has been the nature of extraordinary renditions where the CIA, in cooperation with other governments around the world, dozens and dozens of governments, I would add, arrested people, pulled them off the streets, often innocent people, sent them to countries where they were tortured. There's the famous case of El Masri, a German citizen, who the CIA took in Macedonia, took him to a secret facility in Afghanistan, one of the secret prisons, where he was tortured. He was totally innocent. It took some pressure on Tenet to get him released. Not only has the CIA never apologized, the United States has never apologized for this, but Masri wasn't even permitted to enter the court system to raise the laws that were broken by these agencies of the government who were acting on behalf of the American people. So in order to get where your caller would like to go, which is, I really think, begs the question of, you know, are we dealing with war criminals?
Mm-hmm.
You would at least have to establish the evidentiary base for what is a war criminal and how do you determine a war criminal. But you can't get the courts to open up to the American people for cases such as these because the courts tend to protect the government and all that it does. And my argument has always been that torture was not secrecy. There was nothing secretive about torture. Torture was a violation of law. And I'm sure a lot of your callers have seen this movie, Zero Dark Thirty, and I have a lot of problems with that film. And one of the serious problems I had was that it didn't raise not only the moral issues connected with torture, because torture is immoral, I think we can agree on that, but it didn't raise the evidence and the examples of those people within the government, certain FBI agents, certain military lawyers in the Judge Advocates Corps who were opposed to the use of torture and did raise these issues within their own bureaucratic confines.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, I'm very sympathetic to what your caller is talking about.
Well, and
frustration is, I think, for all of us, that contrarians get marginalized in this country.
Yeah. You make also the point in your book that the United States has objected to the creation of the International Criminal Court, and I believe is still not a member, and that's the one place
we're not
where
a member, no,
right. So
and
that's
it's not. You know, this goes back to the Clinton administration, and Clinton is a highly overrated president in my estimation. And I have a chapter on Clinton,
yeah,
in this regard, a chapter on George Herbert Walker Bush, on George W. Bush, on Barack Obama. Clinton's contribution was keeping the United States out of all of these international arrangements, international courts, international manifestos that we should be a part of. So he bowed to the pressure from the Pentagon because the Pentagon has never wanted to be a part of any international arrangement. So we didn't join the International Criminal Court. We didn't sign the ban on landmines. We didn't sign the ban on cluster bombs, which we've provided to Israel, and Israel has used illegally, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't sign the ban on using teenagers in combat situations. So one of the things I call for is the United States has to be a solid, reliable, and mature member of the international community. Instead, we've associated ourselves with what we like to call the rogue nations.
Thugs.
Because the countries that haven't signed these covenants and these arrangements are countries like, well, such as Yemen and Iraq, and Somalia, some of the countries we think of as so incredibly backward in their traditions and in their national security policies. Well, we're linked with those countries in the minds of the international community.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mel, we have four people waiting to hear from you. Let's try and squeeze all of them in. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to ask about the targeted assassinations, and I wondered if your guests would care to consider in relationship to each other the demise of Saddam Hussein, of the strongman from Libya, and the U.S. citizen that we killed with the drone. It seems like, although it's rather efficient, it's pretty hard to manage in a moral sense as a country.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Mel?
Well, caller raises a very important point. And here, I think, I just looked at the book by the retired General Stanley McChrystal, who had to leave the military because he and his staff were criticizing civilian
Obama.
Leaders of the government. And obviously, they were insubordinate, and so they had to leave the military. But McChrystal's written a very interesting book about his experiences in Afghanistan, and he's very critical of the drone activity. And the point he is making is the incredible amount of anti-Americanism that it's creating by using this system so aggressively. Now, according to the legal memo that was just released by the Obama administration because of the pressure from Senator Wyden from Oregon, this activity is only supposed to be in very extreme situations to prevent the possibility of an imminent attack. Well, there have been 400 of these flights that have killed several thousand people. I can't believe all of these people were involved in imminent attacks against the interests of the United States. Innocent civilians have been killed. A couple hundred children have been killed. Yet you have John Brennan, who's now about to become the CIA director, in a speech that he gave a year and a half ago, said there have been no innocent deaths whatsoever, which, of course, was that wasn't an error or a mistake. That was a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what else it could be. But I think it's just become too easy. As I said early on, we've accepted assassination policy. And remember, I thought we banned assassinations in the 1970s after the Church Committee hearings found evidence of CIA assassination schemes. We've accepted assassinations as a routine part of U.S. policy. Jay Carney has called this legal, ethical, and wise. Well, I don't think it's legal. I don't think it's ethical. I don't believe it's wise. You know, just because the Justice Department writes a memo, as they did, say, 10 years ago to allow the CIA to torture doesn't make it legal. And now that you have these memos that talk about drone activity, and now we can even kill Americans in this fashion without due process, that doesn't make it legal. But it goes back to the previous caller who talked about the soul of the American citizenry. The problem is no one can get into courts. No one can get this information. The American Civil Liberties Union has gone to court to get information and has been very unsuccessful. The New York Times has tried to get this information, and again, very unsuccessful. I should stop now to give other callers.
Yeah, let's see if we can squeeze them all. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi. This might be moot at this point, but one of my questions for your guest is, so at this point, who do you think would make a better CIA chief than John Brennan? Unfortunately, it looks like we are going to have John Brennan in charge of the CIA. And, I mean, what can we as citizens do, given that our president, who is, after all, a constitutional scholar, seems to be willing to pursue the exact same policies with even more fervor than President Bush? And mm-hmm. I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Thank you. Mel.
Yeah, great question and very discouraging, which is, you know, the way I feel right now in terms of being discouraged about the things Obama has done. You know, we supported him. And I speak as a liberal. We supported him because we thought he was liberal and progressive and wise. And he's done some good things. I'm not going to deny that. But he is a constitutional lawyer. He taught constitutional law, and he's not taking the Constitution very seriously. Now, when you look at appointments to the Central Intelligence Agency, this is a secret agency, so it's very important that you have very good oversight. We don't have that at the Congress. The Senate Intelligence Committee does a very poor job under Dianne Feinstein. And if you saw the hearings yesterday, that was a walk in the park for John Brennan compared to what happened to Chuck Hagel a couple weeks ago in front of the Armed Forces Committee.
Mm-hmm.
I would look elsewhere for my CIA director. I wouldn't look at the military. Appointing David Petraeus was ridiculous, and it turned out to be a disaster. The Brennan appointment, I think, is ridiculous. I would look at the State Department. I would look at a career ambassador such as Thomas Pickering or the current Undersecretary of State, William Burns. These are people who have used intelligence and know the importance of collecting and providing intelligence analysis to decision makers who know what strategic intelligence and strategic foreign policy is all about. So until we get in that direction, I think the CIA is just going to become more and more of a paramilitary organization, which it has become. And under John Brennan, who's the father and the architect of the drone policy, it'll be more of a paramilitary organization than it's ever been in its history.
And do you feel there is anything we can do about that?
Well, I find what people don't do is they don't write letters to the editor. They don't call congressmen. I mean, I know you have a new senator in Wisconsin who embarrassed himself at the Hillary Clinton
Ron Johnson
dialogue on Benghazi. He's obviously an extremely inexperienced and...
You'll be in kind.
Well, I don't know what else to say about it. He obviously doesn't know what he's talking about. I think calls would help. Letters would help. Get involved. Join groups that discuss these things. Attend meetings of the World Affairs Council or the American Council on Foreign Relations. But we need some activism in this country. This country is sound asleep. That's why we have been able, or the two administrations, Bush and now Obama, have been able to fight these wars for so long, over 10 years in Afghanistan, where there are no strategic U.S. interests whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to our next caller. Hi, caller, you on the air.
Yeah, thanks for this program. During the Korean War, I was the Air Intelligence Briefing Officer for the zone protecting both Washington, D.C. and New York City. What is intelligence? Intelligence is pattern recognition. During all the mass shootings in the recent times, all are male. My educated guess is that 99% are male. It's in our genes, but none of the media has got it. Secondly, one of the great stories of the last election is that the Mormon doctrine is that all the Indians in the Western Hemisphere are direct descendants of one of the lost tribes of Israel. If so, why don't our red relations speak Yiddish? Thanks for your time.
Okay, and let's get to our fourth caller. Hi, caller, you're on the air. Or maybe we'll get back to that person. It's possible that they've waited too long. Our technology is not that good. Let's try again. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Is that me?
Yes.
Thank you. Years ago, David Rockefeller wrote a paper questioning whether state sovereignty and citizenship were any longer foundations for what the markets need in order to prosper, and that as we become global economies, the notion of a military support for powers of acquisition, namely the financial interests, will be the most prevailing interests. It seems to me Obama is supporting that notion, and that the central banks of the United States, Europe, and even now into the Far East, have really destroyed the notion of national sovereignty, so that our CIA, for instance, is really an omnipresent international unit. Could you comment, please?
Okay, thank you. Mel?
Well, that's more of a philosophical question that I think I can deal with in the few minutes that we have. I'm more of a student of a former president by the name of Dwight David Eisenhower, who talked, one, about the military-industrial complex, and he should have said military-industrial-congressional intelligence complex, because that's what we're living with now, with the militarization of American policy. He talked about the impact of permanent war on civil liberties in this country, and we've had permanent war in this country since 9/11, and we've had a compromise of our civil liberties with the Patriot Act, with the Fourth Amendment on illegal searches and seizures, with the Fifth Amendment on due process, with the Sixth Amendment on speedy trials, on the Eighth Amendment in terms of cruel and unusual punishment. And to see this happen by, again, a constitutional lawyer is very discouraging. But Eisenhower also talked about the Cross of Iron. And the Cross of Iron for Eisenhower was all of the money you put into the military involves the sweat of our laborers, the genius of our scientists, and the hopes of our children. So if you buy more bombers than you need and tanks than you need and carriers that you need, aircraft carriers, these are schools you won't build, bridges you won't build, infrastructure you won't repair. And finally, Eisenhower said, and I have this in the book National Insecurity, he was ruminating one day, he never put it into print, but he said to his close advisors, God bless the United States when the people who sit in this chair after me don't know how to deal with the military. And if you look at American presidents since Eisenhower, they have known, in some cases, nothing about the military, have had no experience with the military, do not know how to deal with the military, do not know how to talk to the military, do not know how to control the military. And that's where we are now. And until the American people sort of recognize this and declare that they find it unacceptable, it's going to allow this state capitalism Goliath that your caller is talking about to exercise a great deal of control. And certainly we saw during the financial crisis of 2008-2009 that nothing was done really for Main Street in the United States, but a hell of a lot was done for Wall Street. And I've seen this in my own lifetime. Whenever there is a financial crisis, the first thing that the government will do, that the Congress will do, is to protect the banks.
Mm-hmm.
It will always be said that these banks are too big to fail, and the banks get bigger and bigger. And the government, whether it's a Democrat or Republican in the White House, will not let these banks fail.
Yeah.
And so that hasn't changed.
So we have about 2 minutes. It occurs to me that we got a lot of callers and some very good questions. We didn't talk a whole lot, actually, about what's in your book. And your book, is it not published yet, or has it sold
better than... The book is out, but there was a problem with the index. So technically, if you go on Amazon.com, you can pre-order it, but I don't think it's going to be available until March the 14th. But I've started to give book talks, and Politics and Prose in Washington had it. But mm-hmm. I think the best way to get it now is to pre-order it
to
on Amazon.com, and you will have it a month from now, mid-March.
And it's titled National Insecurity, the Cost of American Militarism. In the 1 minute that we have left, I'll ask you to react to one of these two. Either give us more suggestions on what people can do rather than despair, or if you want to talk about, I don't know if you've been watching the series Homeland, but if you have, I'd be interested in hearing your opinion. So grab either, and you have about 40 seconds.
Yeah, I watched one installment of Homeland, and I found it laughable.
Mm-hmm.
It was just not based in reality, so I can't really comment on Homeland. In terms of what people can do, I'll go back to what I said to a previous caller, and that's activism. It's just not enough to think all of the right things about these issues, and a lot of your callers, I really do think, care about these things. It's time to make a call to a congressman or a senator. There are people in these offices who must write down these calls. That's their job. They
mm-hmm.
take a name. They write down the opinion, and until senators and congressmen see that there is a group of people who are concerned about foreign policy and national security, they will continue to vote mindlessly the way they vote. And I've talked to congressmen about this, about their votes. You know, we have a senator in Maryland, Barbara Mikulski, who I think is extremely naive and uninformed on foreign policy, yet they put her on the Intelligence Committee, and she sounded foolish yesterday in talking to Brennan. Well, I've called her, I've written. I think you need to do that because congressmen and senators will say, we never get mail. We never get calls about foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
When the Senate voted against the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which I thought was outrageous in the 1990s, and Bill Clinton did a very poor job of explaining this treaty to the people and fighting for it.